All right, hi everyone. We're going to get into the endocrine lecture, and this is going to be coming from chapter 54. All right, so the first thing we're going to start off with is talking about the pituitary gland, which is an endocrine. It's a organ that's a part of the endocrine system. So your pituitary gland is referred to as your master gland. And it's because it has two parts. And we have different hormones that are secreted from this particular gland. So with the anterior part of the pituitary gland, we have different hormones that are secreted that are listed. And then we have also different hormones secreted from the posterior. So some of the things that these hormones are responsible for, they deal with growth, sexual maturation, reproduction, metabolism, stress response, and balancing fluids. So tumors are likely to appear on this specific gland, and the tumor is called a pituitary adenoma. So this is a slow growing benign tumor. So anytime there is an adenoma, it's gonna secrete an excess of a specific hormone causing manifestations related to the action of that specific hormone. So on this slide, I want you to just kind of take a minute to kind of look at the pictures of this particular patient and write down some of your assessment findings. This condition is acromegaly. So acromegaly is when there's an overproduction of growth hormones. So as you can see, based off the picture, you kind of notice that they had excess tissues in their facial features, their tongue is enlarged, the fingers are kind of big. And so this condition is a result of one of those benign pituitary adenomas. So with this condition, there's going to be an overgrowth of soft tissues and bones in the hands, feet, and face. The bones in those specific parts of the body are longer. So as far as manifestations, just as you saw in the pictures on the prior slide, there were extra tissues in the face, some other manifestations. They can have muscle weakness, joint pain, their tongue will be large, their voice will be deep, and their skin, it'll be thick, leathery, and oily. Something that's common in a patient that has acromegaly, sleep apnea can occur due to that extra tissue buildup, and they also complain of headaches. So as far as diagnosing someone with acromegaly, you definitely want to make sure you're doing a very thorough history and physical. And just by looking at the different manifestations that they're presenting with, you can clearly see that something was wrong. Another way to diagnose is doing an oral glucose tolerance test. So we're familiar with this test because this is what pregnant women do whenever they're being worked up for gestational diabetes. So with this specific condition, we can do this treatment. And they're going to look at the plasma insulin-like growth factor, so IG1, and the growth hormone. And so they see how those two things respond to the oral glucose test. And so if it comes out positive, then of course acromegaly is the condition. MRI and CT can be done to see if they have one of those pituitary adenomas on the gland. We can also do an eye examination. And so this is important because the tumor can cause some pressure on that optic, the optic nerve. So doing an eye examination will rule that out. The only treatment for this is they can do surgery to remove the tumor, or they can do different drug therapies. Surgery is usually the best chance for cure and optimal symptom management, especially if the tumor is very small. But patients who have larger tumors or those with growth hormone levels greater than 45, they may need radiation and drug therapy before they go up to have that hypophysectomy surgery. So with the hypophysectomy, this is the surgery to remove that tumor. If the instance where the entire gland has to be removed, that patient is going to have permanent loss of all of their pituitary hormones. So they will have to be on a lifelong replacement therapy of thyroid hormones, sex hormones, and glucocorticoids. So managing this a patient after having this surgery is going to be very important. So we need to make sure that we're assessing the optic nerve because they're working close in an area that's almost behind the eyes. So if they start developing a hematoma, we would need to know. So that's why we need to make sure we're assessing the optic nerve to see if a hematoma can be compressed in or not. These patients, they won't be allowed to blow their nose for at least 48 hours after surgery, and it's because of the approach that they have to do. They're going to have those sutures, so everything's going to be very delicate, so they can't blow their nose or else they'll rip the sutures apart. Same process with coughing, sneezing, or straining. All of that's going to put extra stress on that suture line, so they have to be extra careful. After surgery, they're going to have a mustache dressing. So it's kind of like a gauze that's going to be taped under the nose since that's where they went in. And so monitoring that dressing, we need to make sure that we're looking for any clear drainage that they may be having because that could indicate that they're leaking cerebrospinal fluid, which will place the patient at risk for developing meningitis. These patients, they cannot brush their teeth for at least 10 days, and it's also simply because of that suture line. It has to be protected. And so understanding that with this surgery, the patient will be at risk for having issues with their electrolytes and fluid imbalances because of that being one of the key things that the pituitary gland kind of helps with. So the next thing we're going to talk about is the antidiuretic hormone and some of its functions. So with ADH, we know we probably learned about it in patho. It helps with balancing water and sodium. So this is one of the key aspects of it. It regulates water balance and serum osmolarity. So now we're going to get into talking about two conditions that are affected if something happens with the ADH hormone. So diabetes insipidus and syndrome of inappropriate ADH secretion. We're going to talk about those. So the first one is syndrome of inappropriate antidiuretic hormone, SIADH. So with this condition, the patient has an overproduction of that ADH hormone or the release of ADH despite normal or low plasma osmolarity. So just as we discussed, ADH, it increases the permeability of the renal distal tubule and collecting duct, which leads to reabsorption of water into the circulation. So one of the most common causes of this condition is cancer, especially small cell lung cancer. We can also commonly see this with head injuries or different drugs as well. And table 54.3 discusses those different things. So with this condition, what we're going to see, they have too much ADH being released. So in that instance, the patient is going to absorb more water in that renal tubule system, which leads to there being more fluid intravascularly that doesn't need to be there. But all of that excess fluid is going to dilute the sodium levels and decrease the serum osmolality because all of the fluid is being pulled within the body. So the fluid that needs to be in the blood is no longer there. Everything is pulled inside of the body. So you're going to see fluid retention, that serum hypoosmolality, that just means there's not enough fluid in the serum. We just talked about how it's going to dilute those sodium levels. The chloride levels will be down, and the urine is going to be very, very concentrated. So, how is your patient going to look with SIADH? Your patient is going to be soaked inside. So, let's talk about this picture. It just kind of gives you the seven S's for how your patient's going to present with this condition. So, let's talk about the first one. Stop urination. This patient is going to have a very, very low urine output simply because all of the fluid is inside of the body. It's not being excreted out properly as it should. So they're not urinating. Their urine, with that being said, is going to be very sticky because it's so concentrated. So the specific gravity of the urine is going to be very high, and it's usually about 1.030, which is not good. When we say they're soaked inside, it's going to cause a damper on the layup. So the hypoosmolality, that's what I meant by all of the fluid is no longer in the serum, it's in the body. Also with the sodium, those sodium is going to be diluted, which causes those levels to be below 135. With the sodium being low, the patient is going to have a headache. We know with hyponatremia, this places the patient at risk for seizures. So headache and confusion are key signs that the patient may be getting ready to have a seizure. Their blood pressure is going to be very high because the heart is going to be working overtime trying to get that fluid out, but it can't. And then for number seven, some of the things that, as far as treating it, want to stop all the fluids, they may have to end up giving the patient salt, and then we're going to give diuretics to pull off the excess fluid. So when we say give salt, they can either eat more sodium or they can do the IV 3% saline, which we're going to talk specifically about those treatments on the next slide. So as far as diagnosing, like we said, we're going to be looking at both the urine and the serum osmolality because they're going to be mismatched. The dilutional hyponatremia, so that sodium is going to be less than 135, serum osmolality is down, and that urine specific gravity is up, which we talked about on a previous slide. For nursing and interprofessional care, it's going to be very important that we monitor the intake and output for these patients. Vital signs are going to be important because this patient has all that fluid that's inside, and their heart, of course, can heart and lungs both are working hard. And they may end up starting to have some of that fluid going around the lungs as well. Getting weights on them is going to be very important because that's going to let us know how we can measure with that fluid coming off. And then definitely observing for worsening signs of hyponatremia, so seizures, headache, vomiting, and that decreased neurologic function. So as far as treatment, depending on how bad the situation is, we do have different options. So if they have mild SIADH, we usually just put them on a fluid restriction. And so that fluid restriction is 800 to 1,000 milliliters a day. So that's the treatment for mild, but the sodium has to be greater than 125. That's the for it to categorize under being mild. We're definitely gonna do our loop diuretics, so get that furosemide. In order for us to give the furosemide, though, the sodium level has to be at least 125 milliequivalents per liter. Dimiclocycline is another medication that we can give, and this is going to block the effects of ADH because they have too much, so it's going to block it. So it's going to cause the urine to be a little bit more dilute. That's how it's working. Definitely got to put the patient on seizure follow precautions because we know what those decreased levels of sodium will do. We want to keep the head of the bed flat with these patients and below 10 degrees because this helps decrease the release of ADH. So we get into severe hyponatremia when those levels are less than 120. So in this instance, small amounts of 3% can be given, that through that hypertonic solution can be given. Because we don't want those levels to increase no more than 8 to 12 in the first 24 hours. So sodium is something that we're going to fix slowly, not fast. These patients are also placed on a fluid restriction, but theirs is a little bit is way different from the mild one. So we're going to put them on a 500 milliliter fluid restriction. Other medications that we can give is conivaptan and tolvaptan. Conivaptan is an IV medication and tolvaptan is PO, but we cannot give this to someone who has liver disease because it causes worsened liver function. So our next condition is the opposite, so which is diabetes insipidus. So we're going to see opposite manifestations as SIADH. So with this one, they're not producing enough ADH. So we have a deficiency of that ADH hormone. So based off of the little pathos map here, we have that decreased ADH, which is causing decreased water to be reabsorbed, which is decreasing that intravascular volume, leading to the patient excessively having urine output and their serum osmolality is going to be up. So this is going to cause sodium levels to be increased. So, with the patient that has diabetes insipidus, we classify them as being dry inside. Dry inside. So, there are, we're going to talk about the 7 Ds. So, completely opposite from what the SIDH was. So, for this one, this patient is diuresing. Diuresing. So, they are having a very, very high urine output. The urine that they're putting out, though, is instead of being concentrated with SIDH, with DI, this urine is diluted. So it's unconcentrated. So their low specific gravity, their specific gravity is going to be low. So we're looking at levels of 1.005 with their urine specific gravity. They're going to show with dry inside labs. So they're going to have hyperosmolality. So with when we talked about with SIADH, their osmolality is going to be low. With this one, their osmolality is going to be high for serum. And also their sodium levels are going to be high, greater than 145. These patients, they're very thirsty. They're going to be drinking a lot because of them being dry inside. But they're dehydrated, so everything is going to be dry. Skin, mucosa, they're going to be dry, and their blood pressure is going to be low. So our treatment for DI is going to be desmopressin. We have to be careful with desmopressin because it decreases their urine output, but we need to make sure that we're watching for the sodium levels dropping too fast. So it says death by headache. If this patient complains of a headache, it could mean that their sodium levels are now below 135. So we have to be very careful. So as far as diagnostic studies for DI, their urine, like we said, is going to be very diluted, and the specific gravity is going to be low. So we can do a water deprivation test. So this is where with the water deprivation test, they'll test the body weight before and the urine osmolality volume, and they're going to look at the specific gravity. So, with this procedure, the patient is deprived of water for 8 to 12 hours, and then they're going to give them desmopressin, either subcutaneously or nasally, to see how their body reacts to it. If it's central DI, their kidneys are going to respond to the hormone by concentrating urine. And if the kidneys do not respond, then it lets us know that it's a nephrogenic reason, nephrogenic cause for their DI. So the kidneys are causing the diabetes insipidus if they don't respond to the desmopressin. So nursing and interprofessional care for someone with DI. So for central DI, we're going to give fluids either orally or IV. And then for acute DI, we do IV hypotonic saline or dextrose 5% in water. And so it's going to be titrated to help replace that urine output. We have to be careful with this, especially with the D5W. So we're going to monitor for hyperglycemia if they use that D5W fluid. Very important that blood pressure, heart rate, urine output, all of those things are measured hourly because, again, these patients are going to be very critical. So, the DDAVP, that's the desmopressin that we give for the treatment. And, like I said, it's given in different routes. We can do oral, IV, sub-Q, or nasal spray. In order to measure to see if this medication is working, we're going to be monitoring the blood pressure, the heart rate, their level of consciousness, intake and output, and specific gravity of that urine. Clopropamide and Tegretol. Because these patients are extremely thirsty, those medications can be given to help decrease the thirst. It will help with decreasing thirst. We have a specific treatment for nephrogenic DI, so a little bit different. We want to place them on a low sodium diet, and we can use thiazide diuretics instead. And so also indomethacin. So if the low salt diet and the thiazide diuretics do not work, they can add a supplement of indomethacin, and this is going to help the kidneys to respond better to the ADH. So that's our treatments for those. So this little slide right here is just gonna kind of give you a comparison between the two, showing you the difference between SIADH and diabetes insipidus. So now we're going to get into talking about thyroid dysfunction. So what happens whenever the thyroid is dysfunctioning? So your thyroid hormones are going to be thyroxine, which is T4, and triiodothyronine, which is T3. And these two hormones, they help regulate energy metabolism and growth and development. So this little picture on here just kind of shows you how the brain, and then we have our pituitary gland that's going to release your hypothalamus releases the thyroid releasing hormone, and then the thyroid stimulating hormone is what's going to be released from the pituitary gland. It goes to the thyroid gland, and this is how we're going to get those two thyroid hormones released, and along with calcitonin. This little map down here just shows you how with the thyroid, we want the patient to be in a euthyroid level. If they start becoming and having more, they'll go towards this way, and then for least amounts of that hormone, they go this way. So our first condition is hyperthyroidism. And so with this condition, we're having a hyperactivity of the thyroid gland. And so we commonly see this with our most common form is Graves' disease. And if you know Wendy Williams, she actually has Graves' disease. And so that's why some of her characteristics are significant with her diagnosis. So Graves' disease is an autoimmune disease that's characterized by thyroid enlargement and an excess of thyroid hormone secretion. So the body is going to develop those antibodies to the TSH receptors, and it's going to cause the thyroid to release more of those hormones than necessary. We also have other causes that could lead to hyperthyroidism, but Graves' disease is the most common one. Something that we commonly see occurring with hyperthyroidism is what's called thyrotoxicosis. And this is just a physiologic effect where they have a clinical syndrome of hypermetabolism because of those excess levels of T3 and T4. So take a minute to look at this picture. Look at the different things that you see significant. Write those down. So the first thing that we notice on picture A, this lady, she has a goiter. So a goiter is pretty much just showing you an enlarged thyroid, and so she does have that. If you look at her eyes are kind of almost bulging out. That's called exophthalmos. Her fingers, you see the curving of the fingernails. That's called clubbing, just clubbing of the fingers. You probably can't tell by the hair, but patients that have hyperthyroidism, their hair becomes fine and silky. Looking at picture B, she definitely has dependent edema in her lower extremities. And Wendy Williams, she appeared in the same way with these factors. Palmar erythema, that's just where their palms are really red. They have an intolerance to heat. And we're going to talk about some of the other specific manifestations that they present with according to different systems. So they're coming from table 54.6. So because they're in a hypermetabolic state, let's think cardiovascular. They're in a hypermetabolic state, so everything's going to be fast. Blood pressure is going to be up, heart rate's going to be up, they're going to be experiencing palpitations and a bounding pulse. GI, from a GI perspective, they're going to experience an increased appetite. They're going to be thirsty, but they're also, because they're in their hypermetabolic state, with them having the increased appetite, they're still going to be losing weight. Increased peristalsis, diarrhea, they're going to be going very often. Their bile sounds will be increased. And they'll also have splenomegaly and hepatomegaly, where the spleen and liver are both enlarged. From a musculoskeletal standpoint, because their body is going at this fast pace, they're going to be fatigued. They're going to be weak. They may have proximal muscle wasting. They're at risk for osteoporosis. The nervous system, they're in a hypermetabolic state, so they're going to be experiencing nervousness. They're going to have a fine tremor of their fingers and tongue. They're going to have difficulty focusing their eyes, insomnia. They're going to talk really fast. They have lack of ability to concentrate. They're going to have personality changes. They're very irritable and agitated. And then reproductive system, they're definitely going to have menstrual irregularities in women. They may even have amenorrhea where they don't have a cycle at all. They're going to have decreased libido, decreased fertility. And in men, they experience impotence and gynecomastia where the breast tissues are swollen. This is just a picture, just kind of showing you everything that we talked about. So as you can see how, they got the safety pin in the pants because even though they have that increased appetite, they're not maintaining anything. A complication of hyperthyroidism is for them to go into what's called a thyroid storm. So it's thyrotoxic crisis. So this is just where excessive amounts of the thyroid hormones are released and it's considered a life-threatening emergency. So this can be a result from different stressors. So if a patient with hyperthyroidism were to experience infection, trauma, or undergo surgery, they are at risk for going into a thyroid storm. So if they were to have their thyroid removed, they would go into a thyroid storm. And so with the thyroidectomy, because the manipulation of that hyperactive thyroid gland is being removed, it's going to cause the body to release a lot of those thyroid hormones because their body was so used to it anyway. So as far as implementation for these things that we're going to be helping with to maintain, because with this situation, they have to be placed in the ICU. These patients are going to be given medications to block the production of those hormones and the sympathetic nervous system hormones that they're experiencing. So all of the tachycardia, the hyperthermia, where their body is in overdrive, they're going to be given medicines to maintain all of that. During that time, we need to monitor for dysrhythmias, making sure that they're getting adequate enough oxygen and their fluid and electrolytes are being replaced. So as far as diagnosing for hyperthyroidism, these patients, they're going to have their TSH, so their thyroid stimulating hormone is going to be decreased, and their T4 is going to be increased. That's how they diagnose someone with hyperthyroidism. So there is another way that they can distinguish what led to them developing it, and that's doing a radioactive iodine uptake test. And so that's how they could distinguish between Graves' disease and other forms of thyroiditis. Primary treatment. So for these patients, their treatments are going to be antithyroid drugs. And so those drugs inhibit the thyroid hormone synthesis. So they will start to see improvement in their symptoms with 1 to 2 weeks, but they're going to see actual results within 4 to 8 weeks. And so they're usually on this therapy for about 6 to 15 months. Another treatment is iodine. So iodine helps decrease the vascularity of the thyroid gland, making surgery safer and easier. So if the patient is going to undergo a thyroidectomy, then they'll place them on iodine to decrease it from if they were to remove it, it being so vascular and chances of bleeding too fast. Beta blockers. Beta blockers are going to help with decreasing tachycardia, nervousness, irritability, and tremors. And pretty much what it's going to do is just block those effects of the sympathetic nervous system being stimulated. Another treatment is radioactive iodine therapy. And so this is the treatment of choice for most non-pregnant adults, and it works by destroying or damaging that thyroid tissue. So usually they treat the patients with the antithyroid medications and beta blockers before and during the first 3 months of doing that RAI therapy. This is going to have a lot of patient teaching for the RAI therapy because they're doing this and they're going to be considered radioactive during some of those periods. So the patient may develop what's referred to as radiation thyroiditis or parotiditis, and this is just dryness and irritation of the mouth. So we need to make sure that we're letting them know that. they are going to have to limit their exposure around other people because of them being radioactive. So we're going to recommend to them that they use private toilet facilities if possible. If they use a public toilet, they need to flush 2 to 3 times after use. At home, they need to separate their laundry from other people, bed linen, clothes, especially if they're at home daily. They don't need to be cooking or preparing food for other people, especially with their bare hands, because again, they're radioactive. And they need to avoid being around pregnant women and children for 7 days after therapy. So our surgical therapy, and this indications for this is if they have a large girder that's compressed in their trachea, they've been unresponsive to the anti-thyroid therapy, they have thyroid cancer, or they're completely just not a candidate for that RAI therapy. They would have to have a surgery to have part or their complete thyroid removed. So we have two options. Endoscopic is appropriate for patients that have small no with small nodules and no evidence of cancer, so they can do it endoscopically. The robotic, this one is best for those who are not overweight and have small nodules on only one side of the gland. Both of these methods have a better advantage over doing open, and open is just where they completely open up the throat and remove the thyroid, because with these approaches, there's less scar and less pain, and they can return back to their normal activity pretty quickly. So with thyroid surgery, we have a lot of teaching that we have to do on the forefront and postoperatively. So preoperatively, we need to make sure that the patient is aware that after surgery, they're going to have to maintain head support. So we need to show them how to support their head manually while turning in bed. And this is going to help minimize the stress on the suture line after surgery. Talking may be difficult for a short period after time. We just need to make sure that they're aware of that. Post-operatively, we're going to have to make sure we're monitoring for complications. These patients can have risk with a couple different things. So as far as airway obstruction, because again, they're going in there and they're removing it. If they start bleeding under there, it can compress that airway. So that's considered an emergency. So it's going to be important that at the bedside, we keep oxygen, suction equipment, and a tracheostomy tray available in that patient's room. So if you know your patient's coming back from having a thyroidectomy, you need to make sure all of those things are at the bedside, and it needs to stay there the entire time. As far as these patients with them removing the thyroid gland, because your parathyroid glands are also on the thyroid, so they can be at risk for developing hypoparathyroidism or hypocalcemia, because all of those are closely related with those different hormones and electrolytes as well. Nutritional therapy for someone experiencing hyperthyroidism. These patients, they need to be on a very high calorie diet because, again, they're in that hypermetabolic state. So we prefer 4,000 to 5,000 calories a day. If they need to, they need to do 6 full meals and have snacks in between. We need an adequate amount of protein. So that's the preferred way to calculate it. And then avoiding highly seasoned and high fiber foods along with caffeine, because those are all things that can cause them to go into those hypermetabolic states. So those are things they need to avoid. Hypothyroidism. So now we're talking about the opposite, where we don't have enough of the thyroid hormone being released. So they're going to be in a slow metabolic state with hypothyroidism. So different causes. It could be a result of Hashimoto's thyroiditis, so that can cause them to develop this. Treatment for hyper can lead to them going into hypo. So we're looking at with the RAI therapy, if they've had a thyroidectomy, medications such as amiodarone and lithium, those drugs can cause hypothyroidism. And then cretinism. This is just where it develops in the infancy. As a baby, and it results from deficiencies that they had while they were before they were born, during fetal or early neonatal life, if they had deficiencies, they can develop hypothyroidism. So let's look at this patient. I posted a couple pictures so we can look at it and just kind of tell some of the different things that this patient is presenting with. So dry, thick, inelastic, cold skin. Their nails are going to be very thick but brittle. They have dry, sparse, coarse hair. As you can see on the pictures here, they have a puffy face, and that's on both pictures from the one on the top and the bottom. Pallor, so they're going to lose their color a little bit. Their ability to sweat is going to be decreased. They're going to have an enlarged, scaly tongue. So, the systemic effects of hypothyroidism causes slowing of the body processes. So these patients present with what's called myxedema. So it's in a result from the accumulation of hydrophilic mucopolysaccharides in the dermis and other tissues. So this is why it alters their skin and their face and those tissues with puffiness. So they're going to have that puffiness, their facial and periorbital edema, and they have like a mask-like affect. From a cardiovascular standpoint, completely opposite from hyper. So with their blood pressure, it could be varied, but they're going to have decreased rate and contractions of the heart. So everything's going to be kind of slow with them. From a GI standpoint, they have a decreased appetite, but they're gaining weight. Nausea and vomiting, constipation, their abdomen may be distended. And again, that tongue is going to be large and scaly. Musculoskeletal, these patients are also going to be fatigued, weak. They can have arthralgia, and they're going to have muscle pains and aches and slow movements. From a nervous system standpoint, they're going to have prolonged relaxation of their deep tendon reflexes. Their speech is going to be slow and slurred. They may have forgetfulness, slow mental processes, and they are very similar with the reproductive system. So decreased libido, infertility, they may have prolonged menstrual periods or amenorrhea with women. This picture right here just kind of shows you everything we just talked about with them. So complete opposite from hyper. A complication of hypothyroidism is myxedema coma. So this is precipitated again. So anytime these patients undergo something stressful on the body, infection, different drugs. So drugs such as opioids, tranquilizers, or barbiturates can lead to them going into myxedema coma, being very cold, any trauma. So the treatment for this complication is IV thyroid hormone. That's going to be very important with them. And we're going to talk about on the next slide how we kind of manage with these patients. Laboratory tests for someone with hypothyroidism. So the TSH is going to be high if it's a primary cause of hypothyroidism, and the TSH will be low if it's from secondary reasons. So as far as different labs that's going to appear with hypothyroidism, their cholesterol is going to be up, their triglycerides are also going to be up, and the creatine kinase. Because they're experiencing that intolerance to temperature, their red blood cells will be low, which will cause them to be anemic. Drug therapy for someone with hypo, we do thyroid hormone replacement, so levothyroxine, which is also called Synthroid. We start with a very low dose, and then they kind of work their way up with how much the patient needs to be on. So once they're started, we need to make sure we're monitoring for chest pain, weight loss, nervousness, tremors, and insomnia. If they feel like the patient needs a higher dose, they'll increase it within 4 to 6 weeks or on an as-needed basis. And so with levothyroxine, they're on it forever. So lifelong therapy with this. We're going to do nutritional therapy to help with promoting weight loss in them. And then as far as patient and caregiver teaching with this, these patients need to make sure that they're taking their levothyroxine, because if not, then they can end up going into one of those complications. So now we're going to get into talking about disorders of the parathyroid glands, which are those little mini glands that's behind the thyroid. So hyperparathyroidism, this is our next condition. So with this, the patient has too much parathyroid hormone being secreted. So with the parathyroid hormone, it kind of helps with calcium levels, okay? So think about calcium when you're thinking about hyperparathyroidism. So, there are different causes. It could be primary, secondary, or tertiary. And so those causes are listed. But as far as the manifestations for hyperparathyroidism, they're going to present exactly as someone that has hypercalcemia. Okay. So hyperparathyroidism looks exactly like hypercalcemia. So from a cardiovascular standpoint, their blood pressure is going to be up. They're going to be experiencing angina, which is chest pain, dysrhythmias. And so they're going to have issues with their impulses on EKG as well. So they'll have a shortened ST segment and a shortened QT interval. GI, they're going to have nausea, vomiting, constipation, weight loss. They can even be at risk for pancreatitis, musculoskeletal, because of those increased levels of calcium, weakness, fatigue, skeletal pain. They can experience pathologic fractures of their long bones. They're going to have a backache. Neurologically, they're lethargic, they're weak, their reflexes are going to be decreased, they're irritable. From a renal urinary standpoint, they're going to have increased calcium levels in their urines, which is called hypercalciuria. They can even develop kidney stones from all that increased calcium that they have. Polyuria. They can even develop a UTI. Skin. They can develop moist skin or even skin necrosis. And then visually, they may have some issues with their vision. Complications. So when we're looking at the lab values for them, calcium is going to be up and phosphorus is going to be low because of that seesaw effect with both calcium and phosphorus. Complications because of all this excess calcium that this patient is going to be having, they can develop renal failure, kidney stones, pancreatitis, those cardiac changes that we just talked about, and those fractures due to the excess calcium levels. So our treatments are going to be given IV sodium chloride and loop diuretics. And so we're going to have to make sure we're monitoring those labs and vital signs and educating them on dietary measures with which are going to be decreased levels of decreased calcium. It's going to be key with them. Hypoparathyroidism. So we don't have enough parathyroid floating around. So these patients are going to present as someone with hypocalcemia. So, manifestations wise, and all these manifestations are listed on 54.15. Their blood pressure is going to be down. Instead of having a pro, they're going to have elongation of their ST segment and a prolonged QT interval. GI, abdominal cramps, fecal incontinence, malabsorption from a musculoskeletal standpoint. They're gonna experience weakness and fatigue and painful muscle cramps. Neurologically, hyperreflexia, tetany, positive Shavastic and Trocher sign. Remember, y'all learned about that in patho, talking about hypocalcemia. Paresthesia of the lips, hands, and feet. Even be at risk for seizures. With their urinary system, they're gonna have urinary frequency and incontinence. Their skin is gonna be dry, scaly. They're going to have hair loss, brittle nails, lack of tooth enamel because of those decreased calcium levels. And they may also have issues with their eyes. So, papilla edema, cataracts, lenticular opacities. Those are some things that they may present with. Treatments. Because their calcium levels are low, they need to be given IV calcium or we're off magnesium and vitamin D supplements to help with getting those calcium levels up. As far as dietary, we want to prefer them to be on a high calcium diet. So, dark green veggies, soybeans, tofu, those are examples of things that can help increase the calcium levels. So now we're going to get into talking about the adrenal gland and specifically the adrenal cortex. So the adrenal cortex is responsible for your steroid hormones, and there are three main classifications. So the glucocorticoids, mineral corticoids, and androgens. So your glucocorticoids, which are cortisone, they regulate metabolism, increase blood glucose levels, and are critical in the physiologic stress response within the body. Your mineral corticoids help with regulating sodium and potassium, and so this is going to be aldosterone. Androgens, they contribute to growth and development of both genders and sexual development in men. So we're looking at estrogen and testosterone there. Whenever we say corticosteroid, it refers to any three types of hormones that's made by the adrenal cortex. So our first condition is going to be Cushing's syndrome. Cushing's. So with Cushing's, these patients have too much corticosteroid. So they're going to be in excess with a lot of different things. So common causes of this is if someone has been on corticosteroids for a long period of time, if they have a ACTH secreting pituitary tumor or adrenal tumor. And so some different things that we're going to see is hyperglycemia, and this is because their body has a glucose intolerance, and they're experiencing increased gluconeogenesis, and that's something that you guys talked about in patho. Muscle wasting is going to cause them to be weak. That loss of bone matrix is what's going to cause them to be at risk for osteoporosis and having that back pain. And then their skin, they're going to easily bruise, and that's due to loss of collagen that they're going to be experiencing. These patients also, their wounds don't heal at a good rate. They have a delay in wound healing. With looking at the other steroid hormones, their potassium levels are going to be low, their blood pressure is going to be up, and then they have severe acne. In this instance with Cushing's, women have start presenting with male characteristics and men will start presenting with female characteristics. So with diagnosing someone with Cushing's, there are different ways that we can test. So with this, they can do the CT and MRI to detect to see if they have a tumor. They're going to be looking to see if they have increased cortisol levels because, again, cortisol is one of those hormones. So they have different ways that they can do it. They can give them a steroid, a low-dose steroid, to see if that would help. They're also going to be looking at their saliva to see, and they do it at certain periods. They either do it at the midnight or a late night period where they're going to test their saliva to see if it has high levels of cortisol. They can also do a plasma ACTH where they look at that. And so it depends on the underlying cause or what led to them experiencing Cushing's. So, as far as interprofessional care with these patients, the key thing is going to be trying to get their hormones normalized. So, in the instance where they have to do surgery, they'll, if it's due to them having a tumor, they'll remove it. If the cause is because they've been on steroids for too long, they cannot abruptly stop the steroids. So they're going to gradually kind of discontinue it. So they'll taper it down until they're completely off of the steroids. But you would never just abruptly stop them from being on steroids. So they're going to decrease the doses and gradually get them off of it. So as far as nursing implementation with health promotion, we need to be aware of the patients that are at risk for developing Cushing's. So we know that physicians prescribe patients steroids a lot of times. So that is one of those key things. That's one of the major risk factors. So we need to make sure we're teaching the patients how to adequately use those steroids and how to monitor for those side effects. Regarding acute care, so what we're doing at that current moment, monitoring their vital signs, getting daily weights, monitoring their glucose because we know that steroids affect glucose. Assessing for signs and symptoms of inflammation, infection, because again, they have delayed wound healing. So we want to prevent wounds with them as much as possible. And then for DVT, VTE prophylaxis as well. Emotional support. These patients have a lot of different things going on with their body and it's causing them to look different. So they may feel unattractive or unwanted. So we just need to make sure that we're being sensitive to their feelings and also being respectful. Reassuring them that once their levels are normalized, they will go back to looking normal. Preoperative care, we need to make sure we're maintaining the their hypertension, hyperglycemia, and because they're going to have low levels of potassium, we need to make sure that it's corrected. And these patients are going to need to be on a high protein diet. Postoperatively, so if they have the surgery, we go back to the hypophysectomy and the being a precautious, so monitoring blood pressures, fluid balance, electrolytes. These patients, they're going to be given high doses of corticosteroids during and several days after surgery because, again, we don't want to abruptly stop it. So that's going to help them kind of keep a balance. We also recommend bed rest after surgery until their blood pressure stabilizes because we don't want to put any excess stress on the body. So our next condition is the opposite of Cushing's, which is Addison's disease. And so with this, we have an adrenal cortical insufficiency. So they do not have enough steroids. Their steroid levels are going to be low. So one of the key signs that these patients appear with is that bronze pigmentation of the skin. So as you can see on this picture, this lady is very bronze in color. So those are the different manifestations that they're presenting with, which is completely opposite for someone that has an increase in steroid levels. A complication of Addison's disease is an Addisonian crisis. And so this is where they have a sudden sharp decrease in those steroid hormones. And this is also a life-threatening emergency. The triggers that can cause someone to go into this, infection, surgery, psychological distress, if they have a sudden withdrawal of corticosteroid hormone therapy. So that's why with Cushing's, we taper. We gradually get them off because if we suddenly stop it, they can go into this Addisonian crisis. If they have adrenal surgery or if their pituitary gland is destroyed. So this is also a condition that's going to lead to them being in the ICU, and we have to be very, very careful. So with Addison's disease, there are different ways to help with diagnosing it. So we have a ACTH and a CRH stimulation test. So with the ACTH, we're looking at the adrenal corticotropic hormone. And so that test just looks at the ability to produce stimulation, to produce the ability to produce that adrenal corticotropic hormone. So they're going to give them an IV injection of synthetic adrenal corticotropic hormone, and they're going to check their levels 30 to 60 minutes afterwards. If they have an elevated blood cortisol level, it's normal, but with a diagnosis of Addison's, they have no increase in their cortisol levels at all. With the CRH, that's the corticotropin releasing hormone. So they're looking at how the pituitary gland responds to during this test. So they're going to give an IV injection of the CRH and draw some blood 30 to 60 minutes afterwards. So high ACTH levels with no cortisol indicates Addison's. And if it's absent, then it's going to let them know that it's a secondary adrenal insufficiency. These patients may also present with ECG changes, specifically hyperkalemia. So we know that low and high levels of potassium can lead to ECG changes. We can do the CT and MRI to see if they have tumors, if there are any infections, tuberculosis, or adrenal calcification. Because this patient does not present or their body does not produce hormones, they're going to be on a lifelong hormone therapy. So as far as dosing with them, they're going to take a daily glucocorticoid, two-thirds on awakening in the morning and one-third late in the late afternoon. And for their fludrocortisone, they'll take that in the morning. Them on the dosing and how with that dose, and if they're experiencing any increased stress, they are going to need to increase those corticosteroids so that they don't grow insufficiency. So stress would be if they have surgery or if they've been in the hospital. These patients, we increase their salt because of them having low sodium levels. And so our last condition is hyperaldosteronism, which is called Kahn syndrome. And so with this condition, this patient is producing too much aldosterone. So with this, with them producing too much aldosterone, it's causing them to retain more sodium and secrete more potassium and hydrogen ions. So primary reasons would be a solitary adrenocortical adenoma. Secondary is a non-adrenal reason. So we usually see this with chronic kidney disease, if they have renal artery stenosis, or if they have a tumor that's specifically secreting renin. So with the sodium retention, their sodium levels are going to be up, which is going to cause them to experience hypertension and a headache. They're not going to have any swelling. And they're going to show signs of decreased potassium. So muscle fatigue, weakness, at risk for dysrhythmias. They're going to be glucose intolerance. And they're going to also experience metabolic alkalosis and tetany as well. So we can do a CT scan or MRI to see if it's due to a tumor, of course. And another treatment that they can do, a diagnostic, is a plasma 18 hydroxycortisone level that they look for, that excess aldosterone. So treatment would be to either remove the adrenal glands, and then preoperatively, they usually are going to put them on a potassium-sparing diuretic, the antihypertensive, replacing that potassium, and then restricting sodium. If it's due to bilateral adrenal hyperplasia, they're going to do the potassium-sparing diuretic, and the calcium channel blocker is going to be preferred to help with controlling the blood pressure. They're also going to do the dexamethasone, which is a steroid, to help decrease that hyperplasia if it's due to that reason. And this is going to conclude the endocrine lecture.